This morning I want to answer two questions, or one question, and then get into part of the second anyway. And those are, what is life like in the present heaven, and what will we do in heaven? And the second one will take, we'll go into next Sunday at least, Lord willing. So what is life like in the present heaven? And what I'm going to do for the majority of this question is actually just quote from Randy Alcorn, because I thought he had some really good insights in his book on heaven. This is from pages 65 to 67. It's not exactly a direct quote. It's been a long time since I put this in here, but as I remember, I changed around the Bible versions. He would use false versions, so I replaced his scriptures, so-called, with the real ones. But by and large, this is basically quoting from him. And I thought he had some really good things to say, and I didn't want to just get up here and say the same thing and make it sound like I came up with it all on my own when he did, so I'm just going to read what he said. He bases this off of Revelation 6, 9 through 11, which you can go ahead and turn there, and I'll read that. I've mentioned this passage a number of times, and it's quite fascinating that he came up with 21 things that we can know about heaven from these three verses, which is a pretty good reasoning on his behalf, I think. Revelation 6, 9 through 11. And when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season, until their fellow servants also and their brethren should be killed as they were, should be fulfilled. So from this passage, like I said, Alcorn comes up with 21 things that can be concluded. And so let's just go through those. The first one is quite obvious. When these people died, that is, these martyrs, they were relocated to heaven. So they went from being on earth to die, they went to heaven. That's pretty obvious from the first verse there. Number two, these people in heaven were the same ones killed for Christ while on earth. So they maintain their identity. Their identity went with them from earth to heaven. This demonstrates continuity between our identity on earth and our identity in heaven. We're not going to be different people when we get there. We're going to be better people. We're going to be pure people without sin and things like that. But we're not going to be altogether different people as far as our persons and personalities go. Now, the martyrs' personal history extends directly back to their lives on earth. Those in the present heaven are not different people. They are the same people relocated. As it says in Hebrews 12:23, the spirits of just men made perfect. Let's just turn there. Hebrews 12 and verse 23. Here Paul talks about when we worship God, like we're doing this morning, we're actually joining with those in heaven worshiping God all together, though we're separated by a bit of a distance. Hebrews 12 and verse 22, But ye are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn which are written in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect. So it's the same people. It's the spirits of just men made perfect. It's not, they don't have different spirits or something. It's those same people. Their spirit just left their body here and it went up there, and they maintained their personality and their memories and things like that. All right, number three. People in heaven will be remembered for their lives on earth. These were known and identified as ones slain, quote, for the testimony which they held. So what they did on earth was remembered when they get to heaven. God remembered it. They remembered it. We should all endeavor to be remembered for the testimony which we held when we were on earth. That is what a Christian is by definition, is one who holds the testimony of Jesus Christ, which just brings a verse to mind in Revelation chapter 12. In verse 11, and they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. This is the same. I mean, if it's not speaking of the exact same people, it's speaking of people just like them there in Revelation chapter 6. They had the testimony of Jesus Christ. They loved not their lives to the death, and they overcame. They overcame in death. When they died, they overcame. They overcame the devil and his persecution, because they remain faithful unto the end. And when you do that, you're an overcomer. Even if you do die, you have overcome. And then in verse 17, it says, and the dragon was wroth with the woman, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. That's what a Christian is, a person that keeps the commandments of God and has the testimony of Jesus Christ. This book is the testimony of Jesus Christ. So those martyrs in heaven that we're reading about there, they were remembered for the testimony. They weren't remembered for the businesses they started and the wealth that they amassed and all the kids and grandkids that they had and the streets that are named after them and all the wonderful, amazing things that they did, and the charitable organizations that they founded, and all those things. They were remembered for the testimony which they held. They're not remembered for the things that men ooh and ah about in this life. They were remembered for the things that God cares about, the testimony, the faith that they held. All right, number 4. They cried with a loud voice. Verse 10 means they are able to express themselves audibly. This could suggest they exist in physical form with vocal cords or other tangible means to express themselves. Now, I've talked about this idea of whether we'll have a physical body when we get there, and I gave you my reasons why I don't think that's the case. But just remember, God also speaks audibly at times. Not today to us, but in the past, God thundered on Mount Sinai. God spoke directly to Moses. He spoke to Abraham. And God's a spirit. God is a spirit. They that worship God must worship him in spirit and in truth. So he's spirit. And God the Father is 100% spirit. Right? Jesus Christ has a physical body. God the Father doesn't. God the Father's a spirit. And yet he spoke. So just because they spoke audibly doesn't necessarily mean they have physical bodies. They could. Remember, angels can materialize and they can have physical forms, so we could have something like that too. Number 5, people in the present heaven can raise their voices. Verse 10. This indicates that they are rational, communicative, and emotional, even passionate beings, like people on earth. Emotions aren't sinful. Sometimes we think emotions are sinful. We think, oh, if you're sad, you must have done something wrong or something. Emotions are not sinful. Even anger is not sinful if it is done correctly. The Bible says, be ye angry and sin not. Now, there's lots of anger that is sinful, but Jesus looked on them with anger, and he had never did commit sin. So anyway, emotions are not wrong. As these people show us here, they lifted up their voices. They lamented and cried in heaven, wanting to know how long it's going to be until they are avenged. Number 6, they called out in a loud voice, quote unquote, not loud voices. Verse 10, individuals speaking with one voice indicate that heaven is a place of unity and shared perspective. So that was interesting. They cried out in unison, together. But there's also separateness. This passage teaches that also. We're not just one big blob up there, but we do things collectively and individually. Number 7. The martyrs are fully conscious, rational, and aware of each other, God, and the situation on earth. None of this soul sleep nonsense where the soul and the spirit are lying in the dust, unconscious or something. These martyrs are fully conscious. They are aware. They can think. And not only are they aware of their own surroundings, they're aware of what's happening on earth. Because they want to know how long it's going to be until the people that killed them are judged. Obviously, they know they're not judged yet. So they're aware of some things that are going on down here. Number 8, they ask God to intervene on earth and to act on their behalf. Quote, how long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? Verse 10. Number 9, those in heaven are free to ask God questions, which means they have an audience with God. It's not like God is out there somewhere that is inaccessible to the saints. They can actually ask him questions. They can interact with him personally. We learn that from this passage. It also means they need to learn and continue to learn. Does you know that anytime you ask a question, that means that there's something you don't know? That's how you learn, is you ask questions. If you'll notice, though, most of us don't ask many questions. Most of us talk a lot, tell people what we know a lot, don't ask questions very often. We should all work on that. There's a lot to learn out there if you're just curious and ask questions. In heaven, people desire understanding and pursue it because they want to know why the wicked have not been judged. So they're seeking understanding. Why is it, Lord, that you haven't judged them yet? So they want to understand what is happening and why it's happening. Number 10. People in the present heaven know what's happening on earth. Verse 10. The martyrs know enough to realize that those who killed them have not yet been judged. Now, I don't know that they know everything and all the fine details that are going on down here and can hear every conversation. I hope not. I wouldn't like that. Wouldn't that be something if everything you ever said here, like in the privacy of a conversation, is heard by every single person in heaven or something like that? That'd be terrible. So hopefully that's not the case. There are some things that are nice to be kept private. Number 11. Heaven dwellers have a deep concern for justice and retribution. Verse 10. They want justice. They want the people that killed them brought to justice. See, it is not an evil thing to seek justice. If somebody does something that is a crime, that is wrong, that you've been wronged, there's nothing wrong with wanting justice. Now, of course, for minor offenses, Jesus said to turn the other cheek, go the other mile, right? Give him your cloak if he sues you for your coat, and so on. But when it comes to real injustices, there's nothing wrong with wanting that. You don't feel like you're wrong for wanting to see somebody punished for what they've done. People in heaven feel that way. When we go to heaven, we won't adopt a passive disinterest in what happens on earth. Sometimes we can fall into that after a while when you just see enough evil in the world. You just think, you know what, I just don't care anymore. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to think about it. I don't care. You get numb to it all. But the martyrs weren't numb to it. On the contrary, our concerns will be more passionate and our thirst for justice greater. Neither God nor we will be satisfied until his enemies are judged, our bodies raised, sin and Satan defeated, earth restored, and Christ exalted over all. So, I hope this doesn't burst your bubble, but when you get to heaven, it's not like you're never going to be aware of anything that's evil happening. You're never going to be aware of anything bad. You're going to know about bad things that are happening on earth, but you're going to be a mature person in Christ, and you're going to be able to compartmentalize that and deal with that and not let that ruin your day. So it'll be different. there, but it's not going to be like a lot of people think, where you just don't have any memory of what happened down here. You have no idea what's going on. That's not the case, from this passage makes clear. Number 12. The martyrs clearly remember their lives on earth, from verse 10. They even remembered that they were murdered. See, they even remember bad memories. I've never been murdered before, but I imagine that would be a bad memory. I would think so. Unless you were like shot in the back of the head and you never saw it or heard it coming, then it wouldn't be a bad memory, I guess. But you know, I think most people that are murdered would, you know, probably not want to relive that experience. But these people remembered it. Number 13. The martyrs in heaven pray for judgment on their persecutors who are still at work hurting others. They are acting in solidarity with and, in effect, interceding for the suffering saints on earth. Because they don't, I imagine, they don't only want to see the wicked judged for what they have done to them, but for what they are yet doing to others. So they do have a concern for others on earth and their suffering. This suggests that the saints in heaven are both seeing and praying for saints on earth. Now, it's not like the Catholic thing where the saints are praying for you and you pray to the saints that they'll pray for you and all this silliness. But they clearly are, they know what's going on, or at least they have some knowledge of what's going on down here. And how could they not be praying for us? If they know about us suffering, if they know about us being persecuted, and they see that and they want justice, but then they don't even bother to ask God to have mercy on us. I mean, think about it. Of course they're praying for us if they know about it. That would stand to reason. Why would we don't stop praying when we get to heaven. That'll be a future question. Pray just means to ask, right? I mean, the word is used interchangeably in the Bible. You know, I pray you, which means I ask you. Prayer doesn't stop. You don't stop talking to God and asking him for things when you get to heaven. Why would you? You're not going to be God, so you're still going to need things and want his love and comfort and things like that. So I don't see why we'd stop praying, and why would they stop praying for people on earth that are suffering? Number 14, those in heaven see God's attributes, quote, O Lord, holy and true, unquote, in a way that makes his judgment of sin more understandable. You see, they know God is holy and true, but when they're there, they actually see God who's holy and true. I'm sure they have a much more vivid understanding of the holiness of God, and therefore his judgment of sin for them would be far more understandable than it is for us. That's why I don't think when we get to heaven, we're going to have any problem whatsoever with God burning people in the lake of fire for all eternity, because our thoughts are going to be conformed to his thoughts. We're going to be like him. We're going to see him as he is, and we are going to understand his holiness and why that type of punishment is merited and deserved. Number 15, those in heaven are distinct individuals. It says, quote, white robes were given unto every one of them. Verse 11, there isn't one merged identity that obliterates uniqueness, but a distinct, quote, every one of them. So in the previous point, they lifted up their voice, right, in the singular, like they're all collectively doing it together in a loud voice, it says. But then here, white robes are given to every one of them. So they were unified together, and yet they're individuals still. Just like we are in the church. In the church, we are a unified group. We're called the Excelsior Springs Church. We're one body. But we are individual bodies within that one body. We maintain our individuality, obviously. Every one of us are different. But yet, we collectively come together, and we believe the same thing, and we are in unity on spiritual things. It's the same way in heaven. Number 16. Martyrs The martyrs wearing white robes suggest the possibility of actual physical forms, because disembodied spirits presumably don't wear robes. The robes may well have symbolic meaning, but it doesn't mean they couldn't be physical. The martyrs appear to have physical forms that John could actually see. But once again, you think about God, the Father. He appeared to Moses, and Moses saw his back. God is a spirit, and yet Moses, with his physical eyes, saw God's back. God said he would show him his backside. And if I'm remembering correctly, God refers to himself having a robe and a train and things like that. So God's a spirit, and yet he's got a crown, right? I don't think this necessarily means that we have to have physical bodies there to be given white robes. Number 17, God answers their question in verse 11, indicating communication and process in heaven. It also demonstrates that we don't know everything in heaven. If we did, we would have no questions. That's another misconception. Will we know, people think we'll know everything when we get there. We will not know everything when we get there. If you knew everything when you got there, you would be God, because only God knows everything. Only God is omniscient. We will not know everything. This passage proves that because they asked a question, which means they didn't know how long it was going to be. If they knew it was going to be in 37 days from then at 2:13 in the afternoon, they wouldn't say, "How long, O Lord?" They'd know exactly when it's going to be, right? They don't know. So they're asking questions. They don't know everything. The martyrs knew more after God answered their question than before they asked it. So there is learning in the present heaven. They still didn't know all the answer that they wanted, but they knew more. It was going to be a little while. They knew it wasn't going to be immediately. It's going to take a little while, right? So they're learning. Now, these are principles here. We can take these little tidbits that we can pick up and then extrapolate from them and use reason and logic to come to these conclusions. Number 18, God promises to fulfill the martyrs' requests, but says they will have to, quote, rest yet for a little season. It's in verse 11. So those in the present heaven live in anticipation of the future fulfillment of God's promises, kind of like we still do. Remember what it says in Hebrews chapter 11? Let me just break this up with some Bible verses here. In Hebrews chapter 11, of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Of course, at the time of Paul's writing, they've been in the present heaven for a long time. They're certainly not on the new earth yet. They're not resurrected yet. And look what it says here in Hebrews 11 and verse 16. But now they desire, present tense, a better country that is in heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. You see, they're still desiring that better country and that city that God's prepared for them. So it's not like when you get to heaven, the present heaven, that it's all over. Everything's there. You know everything. You have no questions. There's nothing to learn. There's nothing more to see. Nothing to wait for. It's not true at all. They're still going to be waiting. You're just not going to have this old flesh that's going to make you wait impatiently. You're just going to wait patiently. Trying to find my place where I left off. Okay. Number 18 here. Unlike the eternal heaven, where there will be no more sin, curse, or suffering on the new earth, Revelation 21 and verse 4, the present heaven coexists with and watches over an earth under sin, the curse, or suffering. It's that intermediary period when the saints have bliss up there, but there's still bad things going on earth that they are at least somewhat aware of. So it's not the eternal heaven yet. It's not the new earth. Number 19. This is a time, there is time in the present heaven, verses 10 and 11. The white-robed martyrs ask God a time-dependent question. How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? Verse 10. They are aware of times passing, and are eager for the coming day of the Lord's judgment. God answers that they must, quote, rest yet for a little season until certain events transpire on earth. Waiting requires the passing of time, which I've already gone over in this study when we looked at the question of whether there's time in heaven. There absolutely is time in heaven. No doubt about it. Number 20. The people of God in heaven have a strong familial connection with those on earth, who are called their, quote, fellow servants also and their brethren, verse 11. We share the same Father. Ephesians 3:15 says, of whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. So the saints that have gone on to heaven that are there, we're brethren with them, because God is both of our fathers, just like we're brethren with the children of God down here on earth. And the people in heaven recognize that, right? It says there, until their brethren should be killed, their brethren on earth. So that familial connection is not broken at death. We're just separated by some distance for now. There's not a wall of separation within the bride of Christ. We are all one family with those who've gone to heaven ahead of us. After we go to heaven, we'll still be one family with those yet on earth. These verses demonstrate a vital connection between the events and people in heaven and the events and people on earth. And I think that's why Paul said, you're coming to Mount Zion, unto the city of the living God, to an innumerable company of angels and the spirits of just men made perfect. That passage that I read there in Hebrews chapter 12 just a minute ago. So we have a connection there, though we don't actually see each other. All right, and then lastly, number 21. Our sovereign God knows down to the last detail all that is happening and will happen on earth, verse 11, including every drop of blood shed and every bit of suffering undergone by his children. Voice of the Martyrs estimates that more than 150,000 people die for Christ each year, an average of more than 400 per day. This is what Alcorn says. I have no idea if that's true or not. That's what they say. That obviously is happening like in Africa or the Middle East or somewhere. I don't know. There are not 400 martyrs dying in the United States every day. Not that I'm aware of anyway. But that could be true. I don't know. God knows the name and story of each one. But even if there aren't that many dying now, in different periods of history, there had easily been that many dying. There had been millions and millions killed by the Catholics in the Inquisition and throughout the Dark Ages. So anyway, and the Soviet Union and during the 20th century, millions and millions of people killed, many of which were Christians, or professing Christians. Now, there's a few other things that I wanted to elaborate on a little bit of what it'll be like in heaven. For one thing, the obvious, we will be in the presence of God, and that will be the most amazing part of it. We're told in Matthew 5 and verse 8 that the children of God will see God. They are blessed because they will see God. Peter says, now you see him not, yet rejoicing with joy unspeakable and full of glory. We don't see him yet, but we're going to see him. We shall see him as he is, it says. But anyway, Matthew 5 and verse 8, it says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. So if you want to reason backwards, if you want to see God, be pure in heart. If you're pure in heart, you have the evidence that you're going to see God. If you're defiled and wicked and living like a hypocrite, well, don't plan on it. We will worship God. Let's look at Revelation 7, 9 through 10. Revelation 7, 9 through 10. Worship is going to be a big part of heaven. It's not the only part. I'm going to talk about that here in a minute. But it's going to be a big part of our experience in heaven. So people that have no time for church now and don't care about church and don't care about worshiping God, well, probably not going to like heaven. And you're probably not going there either, for that matter, if that's your attitude. Revelation 7, 9 through 10. And this, after this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands, and cried with a loud voice, salvation to our God which sitteth upon the throne and unto the Lamb. This is worship here. This is a gigantic worship service. People from all different parts of the world, all different time periods, I'm sure, because we're looking at the host of God's redeemed here in heaven, and they're all worshiping him in unison, crying salvation to our God. You see, they've figured out once they get to heaven, if they didn't know it when they were on earth, they figured out that salvation is of the Lord, that God is the one that wrought salvation, not we ourselves. That's one of the things that people are going to learn when they get to heaven. We learn that people are going to learn. People are going to learn that God is the one that saved them, not their personal faith, not their sinner's prayer, not their good works or anything like that. There's going to be a lot of learning, I think, when we get there. And don't get on your high horse. We all in this room are going to learn plenty too. We're going to realize that there's plenty that we didn't know and things that we had wrong, no doubt. But there's going to probably be a lot of Bible studies up there about how God saves sinners, just to get that all cleared up, I imagine. So, because there's been a lot of confusion among professing Christians about that for a long time. So there's going to be no Arminianism in heaven, I do not believe. If there is, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, and I'll be the one learning. But I have a feeling, a very strong feeling, based on what I read in the Scripture, there is no Arminianism in heaven. We'll sing praises to God. Revelation 5, 9, and 10. Revelation 5, 9, and 10. This is, of course, part of worship, singing praises. And they sung a new song, saying, thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every nation, out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, and hast made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. That is, on the new earth. So there's singing, worshiping God through song. And my grandma used to tell me that one of the things that she looked forward to in heaven was being able to sing with a beautiful voice, because I don't really remember her singing. She didn't think she had a good voice anyway. I probably inherited it from her, I imagine. So I'm looking forward to having a nice singing voice in heaven too. And we will serve God in his temple, or before his throne, in his temple night and day. I know we've already looked at some of these passages, but that's all right. It's not going to hurt you to hear them again. Revelation 7, 13 through 15. This is just some of the things that are going to go on in heaven. Revelation 7, 13 through 15. And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, what are these which are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they? And I said unto him, sir, thou knowest. And he said to me, these are they which came out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore are they before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple, and he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. These are these same martyrs, right? Or similar martyrs anyway. They have white robes in their hands. They came out of great tribulation. The Lord's telling them to rest and wait a while. And John sees these people, and they are serving God. That's probably why they had the opportunity there to ask God how long. They're serving him. They're attending unto him on his throne. And probably as they're doing their service, they're saying, Lord, how long? How long do we have to wait until our persecutors are judged? And he says, just wait a while. Take this robe, put it on, just rest. Just wait. It'll happen. In heaven, another thing that it'll a characteristic of heaven is that we'll get to interact with saints that have gone on before us, which would be really interesting. Luke 16:22. It'll be great to see people that we knew here on earth, but it'll also be quite interesting to get to see the saints that lived long before us, you know, saints that we read about in the Bible, like Abraham. In Luke 16:22, remember the story here of Lazarus and the rich man. It says, "And it came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died and was buried." Now, in this account here, we don't read about Lazarus and Abraham talking. We actually read about Abraham and the rich man talking. But I don't think it would be a huge stretch of the imagination to think that when Lazarus was in Abraham's bosom, he was probably talking to Abraham and saying, "Hey, Father Abraham, you know, what was it like when you were on the mount about ready to slay Isaac and the angel stopped you? Or what were you, what did that feel like? Did you really think Isaac was going to die?" Or what? I don't know what. I mean, there's all kinds of, tons of things you could ask him about. Ask him, what did Melchizedek look like? And what was that like? And, you know, what did those Sodomites look like after you delivered them? And, you know, those kings of Sodom, and when they wanted to pay you for it, and you wouldn't take any of the money from them, and all kinds of stuff to ask Abraham about. But anyway, be pretty neat to get up there and be able to spend some time with Abraham. We'll get to rest, which we've looked at this passage before. Isaiah 57:1-2. I think it'd be really neat to get to see if Adam's there. I'm assuming Adam is redeemed. Get to see Adam and Eve. Get to see Noah, Moses, David, Solomon, Daniel, you know, all those Old Testament saints. I think it'd be fascinating to get to see them and talk to them. Of course, most fascinating, of course, would be to see the Lord Jesus Christ and ask him questions for all eternity, because there'd be so many things to ask and want to know. And Isaiah 57:1-2, "The righteous perisheth, and no man layeth it to heart. And merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. He shall enter into peace. They shall rest in their beds, everyone walking in his uprightness." So that's another thing that happens in heaven, is rest. And then, as Alcorn mentioned, learning. We'll continue to learn about God and his grace in heaven. So those of you who didn't like school, well, you better get to like it. Because there's going to be school in heaven. You're going to learn things. It's funny, kids, you know, they can't wait to get out of school. I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to be in a public cesspool either. I spent enough years in one of those places. But kids want to get out of school so badly, which, you know, yeah, I don't blame them for that part. But what they also want to do is get out of learning. They don't want to sit down. They don't want to learn anything anymore. And what they don't realize is, if they're smart, their learning begins when they get out of school. It doesn't end. That's when you can start learning what you want, reading what you want, studying what you want. And then, of course, learning life in the school of the hard knocks. And a lot of these kids are going to learn that, too. You're going to learn what the real world's like, and how it doesn't work the way you think it works and should work. And yeah, especially this generation coming up. These kids, I mean, my generation was bad enough. This generation, these kids, wow, talk about a reality check they're going to have when they get out into the world and realize it doesn't work the way that their woke media have told them it's supposed to work. Everything's just going to be handed to them and whatever. Ephesians 2:7 says that in the ages to come he might show the exceeding riches of his grace in his kindness toward us through Christ Jesus. So the ages to come, he's going to show us the exceeding riches of his grace and his kindness. So we're going to be learning things. The Lord is going to continue to reveal the depths of his grace and his love and his kindness toward us. And I don't know exactly how that's going to work. But I mean, just speculate, why not? You might just sit down and the Lord might just show you all the things that he saved you from that you would have experienced had he not delivered you from it in this life. What he might show you what you could have been had you not been delivered by the grace of God. And it was all by his mercy that he did that. I don't know. Like I said, I'm just speculating at this point. But he's going to show you the exceeding of his riches of his grace and his kindness. So there's going to be learning when we get there. And I have more details about life in the present heaven as we go through this study. So I will be covering that in subsequent lessons here. Now, what will we do in heaven? That's an interesting question. Judy asks, will we spend all eternity only worshiping and singing praises to God? And that is an idea that a lot of people have, right? A lot of people, they think that that's all heaven's going to be. And that's not the case. Of course, worshiping and singing praises to God will be a large part of what occupies our time, a significant part of it. I don't know how much of the time will be taken up by that, but clearly I just read you some verses which show that we will be doing that. But as I will show in the remainder of answering this question, there's going to be a lot of other things that we're doing outside of worshiping God all by itself. There will be many other things that we'll do, such as the things, like I said, that follow in this section. Now, our primary focus in heaven will be God. And we looked at that way back in the very beginning of this series. You'll remember, I think I said that a lot of people look forward to getting to heaven for all kinds of reasons, because it's going to be beautiful and it's going to be happy and we're going to get to see loved ones and there's going to be no more war and no more sin and no more sorrow and all those things. And that's all fine and good, but the main focus is going to be the Lord. But there are other pleasures there which derive from God that we will also enjoy. We're told in the scripture that God hath given us richly all things to enjoy on this earth, and it will be no different in the present heaven and on the new earth. Let's look at 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17. I think what Alcorn called them was Christoplatonists or something. That's probably not the word, Neoplatonists or something. People that follow the philosophy of Plato and think that the material world is evil. That's what some of the ancient philosophers thought, that anything material and physical is evil. And that's why they even came up with these false doctrines, kind of like the Jehovah's Witnesses have, that God created Jesus to then create the earth because God couldn't sully his hands in a physical creation because physical things are evil and below God. So he created another God to take care of that for him. But this is all nonsense. The physical world is not evil. It's been corrupted by sin, and therefore it is evil in that sense. But the physical world in and of itself, as it was created, is not evil. God said it was very good. Plato said it was bad. God said it's good. Who are you going to believe, Plato or God? 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17. 1 Timothy 6:17, charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. See, God has given you everything that you have, every good thing that you have, he's given it to you to enjoy. There's nothing wrong with enjoying physical things. Now, where the problem comes in is when you make an idol out of those physical things and those become the most important thing in your life and you're willing to give up the things of God for those things. You grasp a hold of those things where you can't lose them, you can't let them go, and you'd be devastated if you did. That's a problem. But if you have a Christian attitude toward the things of this earth that God has blessed you with, you can richly enjoy those things. Alcorn's got some really good quotes about that I'm going to give you here in just a minute. He doesn't say here in this verse, charge them that are rich in this world that they divest themselves of everything that they have and get rid of all this evil, filthy money and possessions that you have. Didn't say that at all. It says in the next verse that they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate. So you be ready to be generous with that stuff that God's given you and help other people out with it. And if you have an attitude like that, then there's nothing wrong with having wealth and possessions and things and just enjoying the physical things in this world that God gives us. Look at Ecclesiastes 5, 18 through 19. Ecclesiastes 5, 18 through 19. Solomon says, behold that which I have seen. It is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. It's a gift of God. When you can work and labor and produce things and get money for that and then use that money, either produce the things you want to enjoy yourself or use that money to buy those things like food and drink and clothing and, you know, all the other enjoyable things that we can enjoy in this life, it's the gift of God. And that's what's sad about this generation and these 7 million losers that I've told you about that are sitting in their parents' basement doing nothing, these 25 to 40-year-olds, 7 million of them. That's why they're one of the reasons why there's a labor shortage in the country now. Because of these losers not working, and somebody is subsidizing it all, their stupid parents or stupid girlfriends or whoever they are, these people probably, we're not going to have to worry about them being unemployed because they'll probably be dead, because they'll probably commit suicide, a lot of them, because it would be a miserable existence for any decent person to be sitting around playing video games for 40 hours a week, and that's exactly what they're doing. Clocking 2,000 hours of video games, it'd be a miserable existence when you're not working and producing anything and you're just goofing around your whole life. Bunch of losers. I feel bad for them. Their parents ought to beat them. As a matter of fact, somebody ought to beat their parents. That is one thing that parents should not tolerate, is laziness in their kids. They get to be teenagers, make them work. Don't give them allowances, don't give them money, make them work. Provide their food, their clothing, and their shelter, and anything else they want, make them work. Make them learn how the real world works, and give them that feeling of gratification for hard work done, money received, where you've actually contributed, you've done something, you've made your own way. That's really important, and that is lacking in this wicked generation that we live in. But anyway, God's given us richly all things to enjoy. You want to steer between living too lavishly, wasting all your money, going out to eat all the time, that kind of thing. But you want to steer between that and never enjoying any of your wealth, never going out to eat, never buying anything for yourself, always apologizing to yourself and everybody else for every penny that you spend. You got to steer between the extremes. Yes, live for the future, prepare for the future, lay up for the future, but take a little bit of it and enjoy it in the present. Took me a while to figure that out, but I figured that out. And if you're somebody like me who has a hard time doing that, most people don't have a hard time blowing all their money. Most people have a hard time not blowing all their money. But if you're like me and you have a hard time spending money, I'll tell you what you do. You budget your fun money. You budget a certain amount of money every month, put it in a separate account or an envelope or something for fun money, and you use that. And if there's money in there, go have fun. If there's no money in there, don't go have fun. It's real easy. I recommend doing the same thing. This is another thing that I thought of. Do the same. If you're somebody that it doesn't come naturally to be generous and buy things for other people or give to other people, right? Some people it comes naturally. Some people it just doesn't. Come up with a generosity fund. Put a certain amount in that every month. And this is money I'm going to spend on other people. Charitable giving. I'm not talking about the Lord's money. I'm talking about, you know, something other than the Lord's money. Charitable giving, just doing nice things for nice people. Whatever you want to do, put a certain amount of money in there. And then when it piles up, you're like, oh man, I got to do something with this money. I'm not going to spend it because I purposed I'm going to spend it on other people. And then you figure out, well, I got to do something with it. And then you, it can actually force you to think about others if you're not naturally inclined to do that. Because there's some of us that I just don't think about stuff like that. So it helps me to have something like that to prompt me to remember to do things like that. Maybe other people don't have that problem, but that works for me anyway. So anyway, getting back to the point, God has given us richly all things to enjoy on earth, and I don't see any reason why it's going to be any different in the present heaven and the new earth. We're still going to be given lots of things to enjoy. I'm going to read you some quotes here from Alcorn again, because I thought he really nailed it, hit the nail on the head with some of these quotes. This is from page 176 in Alcorn's book on heaven. He says, our primary joy in heaven will be knowing and seeing God. Every other joy will be derivative, flowing from the fountain of our relationship with God. And I agree with that. That's the primary thing we ought to look forward to, is seeing God. But there will be other joys that will derive from God. And that's what he's going to go on to talk about here. He says, suppose you're sick. Your friend brings a meal. What meets your needs, the meal or the friend? Both. Of course, without your friend, there would be no meal. But even without a meal, you would still treasure your friendship. Hence, your friend is both your higher pleasure and the source of your secondary pleasure, the meal. Likewise, God is the source of all lesser goods, so that when they satisfy us, it's God himself who satisfies us. In fact, it's God who satisfies you by giving you the friend who gives you the meal. You see, all these gifts, everything comes from God. So if you're a Christian and you're thinking in this way, you can drink that cup of coffee to the glory of God. I'm dead serious. You can literally drink the cup of coffee to the glory of God. You can thank God for that coffee, and I do frequently. Or eating that good meal, or enjoying that time with friends, or reading that good book, enjoying that sunset, or that sunrise, or looking at a beautiful mountain landscape, or the ocean, or whatever. Any of those things. You're not worshiping those things. Those things aren't your idols, but they are gifts from God. And if you realize that they come from God and that he's given you those things richly to enjoy, then that can be an act of honoring God by enjoying those things. He continues here. He says, when I speak elsewhere in the book of the multifaceted joys of the resurrected life in the new universe, some readers may think, but our eyes should be on the giver, not the gift. We must focus on God, not on heaven. This approach sounds spiritual, but it erroneously divorces our experience of God from life, relationships, and the world, all of which God graciously gives us. It sees the material realm and other people as God's competitors rather than as instruments that communicate his love and character. It fails to recognize that because God is the ultimate source of joy and all secondary joys emanate from him, to love secondary joys on earth can be, and in heaven always will be, to love God, their source. I think that was very well said. Very well said. So when you love the things that God has given you richly in this life, and you love them in a proper biblical context. You're loving God who gave them to you. I'm a simple person. You know, I love that Yeti mug that I have. But I can love that, and I can love God by loving that Yeti mug. Because God's the one that ultimately made the stainless steel, or he made the iron, which then was made into stainless steel by some clever guy that figured out how to dig it out of there and then melt it down and combine it with lime or whatever they make steel with. I can't remember. Anyway, and then some guy figured out how to vacuum seal it and make it, you know, so it has awesome insulation properties. Anyway, somebody figured out how to make that thing, but you know how they made it? How that person or the team of people made it? You know how they did that? Because God gave them a brain and a mind to be able to figure stuff out like that. So ultimately, when I enjoy that Yeti mug every day, that's an act of worship of God. That sounds weird, but I can praise God because He made the stuff and He made the people that could make that mug that increases the quality of my life. And it does. When I can sit there and drink a cup of coffee for an hour and a half and it stays warm, it increases the quality of my life. Now, you may think that's just stupid and I'm just being goofy. And I mean, maybe there's an element of goofiness in this, but there's an element of truth in what I'm telling you too. You can literally thank and praise God for all kinds of things if you do so, you know, and with that biblical mindset. As a Christian, we can enjoy all good things that God gives us. I mean, how about the church? How about what we're sitting in right now? Our family, friends, food, drinks, good conversations, work, nature, sunset, sunrises, moon and stars, music, literature, snow, springtime, fall, the changing of the leaves, mountains, oceans. What are all the things that God's given us in this world? And that's just a tiny sampling of them. We can enjoy all those things, and we will enjoy all those kind of things in heaven too. And when we enjoy them in heaven, it's not like we're going to be diverting our focus away from God and we're just going to be materialist and we're just going to be so enamored with all this stuff that we forget about God. No, especially not in heaven, because our minds are going to be perfectly conformed to the image of Christ, and we're going to think like God does, and we're going to be perfectly balanced. And that's the one thing that I look forward to being in heaven. That's one of the things, is being balanced and thinking about the things that I should be thinking about at the time I should be thinking about them. Because on earth, I don't know about you, but with me, it's hard to be balanced. It's hard to be thinking about the things of God when I should be, and thinking about the things of work or business when I should be, and thinking about the things of family or relationships when I should be. I tend to be thinking about things way too much when I should be thinking about other things, right? So that's one thing that I look forward to, is being in a place where I'd be perfectly balanced. And when I should be worshiping God and focusing my mind on worshiping Him, that's what I'll be doing. And when I should be working and thinking about that, that's what I should be doing. And when I should be spending time with people and enriching relationships, that's what I should be doing. And I'll be doing just the right thing at the right time in the right proportions. I really look forward to that. Because it's, I don't know about you, but like I said, it's hard to be balanced sometimes. But in heaven, we'll be able to enjoy all that stuff and truly being thankful to God and worshiping Him through enjoying all those things. Because our mind won't be corrupted with sin and with depravity, and we won't have the urge to be covetous and the urge to be idolatrous and to put all those things in place of God, but rather to enjoy those things as a gift from God. Let me finish up a couple of quotes here, and I think I'll be done for the day. Alcorn continues, he says, "We shouldn't ignore or minimize God's lavish creative gifts, but we should enjoy them and express heartfelt gratitude to God for all of life's joys. When we do this, instead of these things drawing us from God, they draw us to God. That's precisely what all things and all beings in heaven will do. Draw us to God, never away from Him." Think about that. There are a lot of people in this world that will, if you allow them, will draw you away from God. Right? There's bad people. There could even be good people in this world that they will draw you away from God because they will get your time and attention focused away from the Lord, and then you'll get off balance and you'll be doing a bunch of things and focusing your life on a bunch of things that you really shouldn't, and you've been drawn away from God. But in heaven, no person will ever draw you away from God. Every person there will draw you to God. Every person there will be an encouragement to you and you to them to focus on the Lord, to serve the Lord, to love the Lord. There will be no bad influences anymore in heaven because there will be no bad people, including you and me. Because we have the flesh, we have badness in us, and there will be no badness. So no person or no thing will be drawing you away from God in heaven. What a marvelous time that'll be. Every day we should see God in His creation, in the food we eat, in the air we breathe, the friendships we enjoy, and the pleasures of family, work, and hobbies. Yes, we must sometimes forgo secondary pleasures, and we should never let them eclipse God. And we should avoid opulence and waste when others are needy. But we should thank God for all of life's joys, large and small, and allow them to draw us to Him. And then on the next page he says, beholding and knowing God, we will spend eternity worshiping, exploring, and serving Him, seeing His magnificent beauty in everything and everyone around us. I think that was well said. I think what he said there resonates with the spirit within me, that what he's saying there is in accordance with the scripture and makes sense to me. And I think that was some pretty good, pretty sound wisdom that he shared there. And that's why I wanted to share it with you, because he said it better than I could have. And all I did was elaborate on it a bit. So next time we'll pick it up here and we'll talk about things that we are going to spend our time in heaven doing. And there will be a number of them. So we'll talk about that next time, Lord willing.
Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches to see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.